Hello and welcome to the Local Economic Development Podcast.
Hosted by Sean Cunningham
and Jörg Meyer-Starmer.
For other programs in this series, please take a look at www.ledcast.net.
In this program, I'm going to have a conversation with Jerry Delaney, who is an LED practitioner in South Africa with a long experience in this field. And he's one of the leading practitioners in the field of BRE, which stands for Business Retention and Expansion. And that is what we're going to talk about in this episode. Hi, Jerry. It's good to have you in this show.
Thanks, Jörg. Nice to be speaking to you.
So maybe we can start this episode by just explaining what BRE means, and maybe just start by explaining where it comes from. So how did it start and where?
Well, BRE or BR&E, as many people would refer to it, has been around for about 20, 25 years. It started in the United States. But perhaps I should go back a little bit and say BR&E, as I would speak of it now, is a formal approach to expanding and retaining business. But we've been doing expansion and we've been doing retention for a very long time. So the whole, any activity that in fact keeps a business in a community or helps a business to grow is loosely termed business retention and expansion. But it became formalized about 20, 25 years ago in the United States in response to, I think, resentment in businesses to the amount of effort that we've been put into attracting businesses and to developing new ones. And people were saying, well, we're here, we're in town, we've been around a long time, and nobody pays any attention to us. And a formal program was developed from that. Now, there's basically two broad approaches to it. One of them focuses on the business. A professional would come and interview a business person and say, you know, what are the issues that concern you? How could you become more competitive? Is there any risk of you leaving town? And so forth. And another one focuses on the environment to a much greater extent and fits as a result much more easily into local economic development.
So it's kind of the alternative program to what many people would refer to as smokestack chasing, where government is throwing large amounts of money at companies in order to attract them to a given place, in order to attract a factory, a company to a given place. Whereas this effort is then probably much more cost-effective, much less building on throwing incentives, grants, tax exemptions at companies, and trying to expand what you have already in a much more cost-effective way.
Well, very much so. If one looks at the impact in terms of the number of jobs created, if you look at all the new jobs that might be created in an economy, something like 10%, maybe 15% are created by attracting new smokestacks, you know, from outside the community. A bigger number, maybe 10 or 20%, would be from new startups within the community. The remainder, so that means between 60 and 80%, will come from the growth of existing business. And that's the bit that we pay very little attention to. And that's what we're saying business retention expansion is all about and is worth having a formal approach to.
So what you just said is that there are two angles to BRE. The one is where you're working directly with companies, and the other one is where you're working with local government, with probably service providers and other actors in order to create a better and more business-friendly environment. Maybe let's start with the first point. So when you're interacting directly with companies, with business owners, what is that? What do you do there?
Basically, what I was saying was that there are two broad approaches to it. One can do one or the other, but one really does both. So it's a question of whether your main focus is actually on the business or on the environment. If you focus on the business, it's quite intensive in terms of resources and expertise. And it doesn't really address environmental issues. So it will help a business with its individual productivity and competitiveness things. But, you know, if you've got a problem with a street sign at the end of the road, that doesn't get covered. You know, it's all inside the fence. And it's from government to business, business to government, one-on-one. So that takes quite a lot of effort and quite a lot of resources. And it's not very common, except in the more prosperous countries. And even there, the majority approach is the second one, where one looks at a collaborative approach to business problems in a particular place. So there, the question is, well, how do you find out what those problems are? Because clearly, if you're going to do something to help business to grow in or to keep it in a particular community, the first question is to find out what are the issues. And there you decide, well, who's going to ask the question?
So is that then an open process where you say, well, we can cover pretty much anything from interaction between companies, how to stimulate learning or collaboration among companies, or how to address market failure in the business service market, and how to look at what the government is doing, look at the road sign and the potholes and the stuff, and stuff like regulations, laws and their implementation. Or do you have a specific angle, a specific focus that you primarily look at when you do an BRE project?
It's very much all of the above. But to some extent, the focus is determined right at the beginning of the process, where you say, where are we going to do this? Are we going to do it within a particular sector in this area or focus on a particular locality? Now, if I talk about how you do it, it sometimes explains why you reach certain conclusions. You know, one way is to actually contract a consultant to go and ask all the questions. The problem with that is the matter of ownership. And the way that has gathered most momentum, and is the way that we tend to follow, is one of using volunteers. It doesn't save you money, although that it might. That's not the objective. The objective is that you get people to go in a particular community to go out and canvas business, use a structured interview as an excuse, I guess, for a conversation between the community and the business people, and you use that as your starting point. Now, the strength of using volunteers for it is that you've got a ready-made audience for the results, and that ready-made audience is very likely to want to do something about it, because it does depend on local energy to make things happen.
So when you see volunteers, what kind of people are we talking about, and how do you recruit them? Where do you find them?
Well, the recruiting process is very much a key step right at the beginning, where you're looking to drive this program with a local task team who identify where they're going to do this. And one of the things that they do when they decide where they're going to do it is where we will get a response. So you want a response from the business people themselves, their willingness to be interviewed, feeling that they might respond to the results when the time came and actually want to do something together. And in that, you start to shoulder tap people to be volunteers from the business community, but also definitely from outside the business community. So you have a partnership between people who don't know anything about business and people who do. And that way you start to build quite a lot of additional social capital in the process. And it helps you later on when you're actually starting to make things happen that breaks down barriers.
What you said just now is that initially you're doing a lot of interviews. Is the process mainly based on interviews, or do you also have meetings, workshops, and other types of formats?
It tends to be structured very much on interviews. And one of the advantages of the approach that we use is that it's very well developed. You might say it's low technology. It isn't very reliant on big input from outside resources. And in fact, if you've done it in your community once, you can probably do it entirely with local resources, except maybe when it comes to analyzing the results. And as a result, the focus tends to be on the structured interview, because it's predictable, it's easier to manage than a workshop. There's no reason why you couldn't workshop in it as well. But the more you do that, the more you draw on external resources.
When you conduct interviews, you send out those volunteers, and they get what? They get some kind of guideline or a proper questionnaire of 30 pages, or how do you handle that?
They do get trained on a four-hour course to use a structured questionnaire. But the questionnaire is fairly loose. It's not one where you're expecting a lot of academically accurate and scientifically correct results. There's a lot of space up for tell me more. So a lot of discussion comes out in that.
So you're asking mostly open-ended questions or closed questions where people say yes, no, maybe, or 1, 2, 5, or how do you do that?
There are some closed questions, and there are some multiple-choice questions, but they all say and other, and we're really interested in the and other. And there are quite a number of open-ended questions, and they're usually the most interesting ones.
So then people go out, the volunteers go out and conduct the interviews. How many would they typically conduct?
They go out in pairs, and they typically conduct between 4 and 6 interviews. Anything more than that, and they tend to get a bit tired. Typically four we found is good. We've had one place where we had more volunteers than we needed, and they did about two, and I think people actually wanted to do more and a little dissatisfied with that. Because, you know, they really enjoy it. And the whole interaction is considered a lot of fun. It really raises the energy levels in a community.
So what would you reckon in a medium-sized town, what is the number of interviews you would like to have conducted? And how long does it actually take to conduct all those interviews?
Well, obviously the interview itself isn't all that long. It takes between an hour and a half. And you try and do them all in a two-week period. In the United States model, which is a lot older than ours, so they allow maybe 4 weeks to do it. We find that if you do that, you don't get anything done in the first week, and you get nothing done in the last. So why bother with those 2 weeks?
All right. So now you've conducted all those interviews, and now what? What is the next step in the process?
Well, the next step in the process is to analyze the results, and that means using either a database or perhaps you can get away with using a spreadsheet, but to get a sense of what's going on. And obviously, the closed questions, it's easy to say X percent say this and Y percent say that, which sort of brings me to that earlier question of how many do you do? Well, you can get figures very easily to say what percentage of the population randomly selected will you give you certain results with 95% confidence. And actually, it really doesn't make a heck of a lot of difference once you get beyond a population of, say, 100 businesses. Between that and 1,000 and 10,000, it tends to be much the same sort of number. And so we're not talking about large numbers of interviews. So we take the results, crunch the numbers when there are numbers, and summarize the comments, but fairly crudely. And these then are workshopped with the task team. This is a group of local people, fairly representative of the community with a strong business bias to it. And that's a fairly intensive one-day workshop, and they look at what the findings are, the key issues that emerge from that, and start to generate proposals for action.
So you have this two-week process where you conduct the information, where the interviews are conducted, and then you personally, or you and your associates, process that in a relatively short period of time, so that the interval between the research and the presentation of findings is probably relatively short. How do you handle that?
Well, actually, you start processing the data as soon as it's done, because it's quite important when the first interviews are done to see the results. That way you pick up mistakes. One of our learning points was not to do that in a particular community. We found a mistake that was there and got quite widespread. We could have picked it up in the beginning and saved ourselves some trouble. And, in fact, a lot of that entry is done by the local person. One of the key role players is what we call a local coordinator. And that's a fairly meticulous organizer. It's not a highly specialized task, but it's a very important one. And a lot of hinges around that person. A local person, they've got to know where the streets are, they've got to know where all the businesses are and who to speak to and so on, and they fix up appointments and they enter the data. We will manage it, we will supervise it, quality control it, and we may from time to time actually end up doing it ourselves. But it's not critical work, in the sense that most of the things are fairly clear. The difficulties might be some of the interpretations of the comments, and we monitor that.
So then you workshop that with your local team, with local stakeholders, define activities, and then what?
Well, proposals are developed from that, which are then fed back to the people that we've interviewed and the volunteers and anybody else who's interested. So all volunteers get invited to the feedback session, likewise the companies that were interviewed and any role players that might actually play a part in the future. And proposals are placed in front of them in the context of the findings that, you know, are what we've seen. And they're invited then to modify and comment on those and to prioritize them for the actions that they might implement themselves or implement by persuading other people to do something about it. But they keep responsibility of it themselves. And task teams or action teams are formed around each one of those. In our early days, we spent, we were far too ambitious with the number of tasks. We've learned a bit from PACA, actually, in trying to get priorities clearer and less ambitious projects, and as a result, more done in the end. And what happens then is that you have a task team which then hands over to a bunch of action teams, and they can continue working on that for up to a couple of years. And it's amazing how much energy remains in the community on that, although it does pay to go back from time to time to have a booster shot.
Let's maybe just for a minute look at the activities that come out of this. Could you give us a few examples of kind of typical things, typical activities that come out of a process like this one?
Well, there can be quite a variety of things. In South Africa, in quite a lot of centres, you have, for example, issues of crime. And people tend to shrug their shoulders and say, well, that's something for the authorities to deal with. But in a number of places, we've discovered that, in fact, if people get together, they can do something about it, including things like cleaning up the neighborhood, clearing away bush on a vacant site, starting a neighborhood watch process, which may eventually lead to a business improvement district. In one particular area, it stimulates the development of video surveillance, using both linking company equipment with municipal equipment. So quite a lot can happen in that sort of regard. Then there are other things which can be as down to earth as one particular company is battling with its business. It's got orders, it's got export orders, it's got a quality product, but it can't actually make money, and they're going down the tube. So the team would actually link them to a resource where the individual company gets assisted. A number of companies in places that we've been and spoken about customer service, never their own, of course, but always somebody else's, but clearly an issue. And they've got together and identified a local person to be trained in customer service skills and run training programs for them. One place that we went to, the issue of the internet came up, and most of the companies there had a website. Almost all of them had either no benefit from the website that they knew of, or couldn't tell you if there was a benefit or not. In the same group was a company that was entirely website-driven and had operations in the UK and Australia and parts of Europe, all driven from this little place here in KZN. And they said, well, we'll show you how to use your website for free. All you have to do is pay for my coffee. And they ran a series of seminars for these other companies, which were highly successful and were implemented within a matter of a fortnight. So, I mean, there's a whole range of things that can be done in addition to getting the potholes fixed and the traffic lights to work.
Maybe I should just explain that KZN is KwaZulu-Natal, one of the provinces of South Africa. There was another term that you just used that maybe not everybody has heard before, business improvement district. So what do you mean by business improvement district?
Well, I know that different countries have different names for this. In each of the main cities in South Africa, we have a different name for it, just to show that we're all different. But it's a way whereby the business community in a particular locality, maybe even a street, will band together and then will put money into a process of maybe keeping the street clean, dealing with crime, making it more attractive to customers, maybe even conducting events to get more feet on the pavement, people through the door, and make it a better business environment.
So it's what other people would call maybe beautification, creating a better experience for customers, making it nicer for everybody.
It is that, but it can also deal with stuff like infrastructure as well, dealing with electricity supplies or improved phone services or changing traffic routings, a variety of things, basically to improve the business in the area. It's got a number of names, and the main street programs that you get in countries like the United States and New Zealand are not dissimilar.
So looking at the follow-up, these activities are implemented then, and what typically happens then? Do you keep the momentum for quite some time, and then you have another round, another meeting with your local hosts, your local champions, or is it just fading out, petering out at some stage, and you say, okay, we have fixed a couple of things now, we've reached a higher level, and that was definitely worth the effort. But now things can go back to normal, and all the businesses can carry on operating in a just better environment.
Well, there's a number of ways you can do this. A very useful way of keeping the momentum going is to use the findings and the results and some of the actions as input to the local economic development strategy. So it becomes integrated into it and doesn't require to be sustained in its own right. But another way of building momentum, apart from the obvious business of reconvening and feeding back progress, is to run another survey, either in a different place or in a different sector, or with the passage of time, like over 2 years, in the same place, to see what's changed and what are the new issues. And that can be very interesting in itself.
When you look at your practical experience, who is typically driving this? Who is the organization or the person who comes up with the idea to do that? And who is then the organization that contracts somebody like you?
Well, it's probably quite useful to talk about the main role players, but in, let us say, a place like a province of South Africa, there might be one or two main organizations that would be program managers. And their task is to promote the program, to train people to run it, and to provide the resources in the sense of the manual, the book, to help people to do this. At a local level, then, there's what we would call a sponsor or sponsors. And that's frequently the municipality in partnership with the organization that represents business, a chamber or something of that nature.
Sorry to interrupt. So at provincial level, you're looking at what? Department of Economic Development or a provincial economic development agency, or what kind of body is promoting BR&D?
It doesn't really matter which it is. In this province, it is in fact the agency that promotes investment, both domestic and external, and it has the advantage that it knows where incentives are and where the resources are that might help business. So it is an agency of the Department of Economic Development. In the city of Durban, or Etekwini, the one that we're in as I speak, it is a very similar agency belonging to the Metro. But it wouldn't have to be so. It could be a chamber, it could be an academic institution, as long as it has broad enough credibility over a big area and some resources to train, to promote, and indeed to be listened to. But at local level is really where it counts. And indeed, at local level, you can do it without having a provincial or regional agency, if you're enthusiastic enough. The key role players there are the municipality and the business organization, whatever that is, preferably working in partnership. And they're the ones that find the resources to set the program up in the local level.
Is it possible to roughly estimate what the price tag is for one BR&E project, contracting some external specialist? Maybe you need some money to hire venues for your internal meetings or stuff like that?
It's very difficult to put a number to it. One can put a value to it and say that if you had 120,000 rand, you could do a business retention and expansion program in a small town or a part of a larger one in South Africa. And it is low cost because you're making use of local resources as much as possible. You can reduce that quite a bit if you want by drawing on existing resources. In other words, no charge for the venue. Use an existing person to be your coordinator. Then it becomes a no-cash deal, but it still costs you the same. So the two bigger costs are the cost of that person, the local coordinator, who does all the arranging and will spend up to 40 days over a 3 to 4 month period doing that work. The other big cost then is to drawing in a facilitator from outside. And in the early stages, when you have no experience of it and you're doing it for the first time in your community, you'll draw on that person for maybe 10, 12, 15 days. As you get a bit more experience over time, then you can cut that down to a few days, 3 or 4 or 5 days.
What you mentioned earlier is that there is a manual on BR&E, so maybe you could just explain how to get hold of that or where to find that. And is there also maybe something published, some case studies that could explain to people in a very practical way how other stakeholders, how other locations have actually applied this methodology?
Well, I think the best resource for this type of information is an organization called Business Retention Expansion International, which is based in the United States and is very strong in North America, but has grown in strength in Australia and New Zealand and in other parts of the world as well. And their website is www.brei.org. And they have a lot of resources on where to go for training, where to go for information of how it's done, case studies, sample surveys, things like that. Because there are different ways of doing it. There are shades of emphasis, and different countries have, even within themselves, different ways of doing it, but the fundamentals are there.
Jerry, maybe to wrap up this conversation, there's a couple of methodologies around to stimulate local economic development. What would you describe as the main advantage and the main disadvantage of a BR&E approach?
Well, I think one of the main advantages of BR&E is that it's simple and it's straightforward, it's clearly set out. It's something that people don't need a lot of particular expertise to do. And it's something that you can pick up from a local level with a reasonable degree of ability and make it happen. The downside of that is that it is not so flexible. It tends to be fairly limited in the scope and size of the area that you can survey. You have to focus. You can't do a big sector, you can't do a big chunk of territory. You also tend to get a limited range of results because you're asking the same questions and you tend to get very similar answers from one place to another. Well, yeah, cost and simplicity and the ability to make it happen with limited resources. On the other hand, you've got to have volunteers. You've got to have people to drive it. You've got to have people to do the interviews. And so if an area is in trouble or very busy, you're not going to get any response, although that can be true of other initiatives as well. I think it is particularly true for BR&E.
Have you ever tried something like this in a let's say, low-income setting, a place like a township?
I haven't personally. A colleague of mine has, and she claims that it works very well, but I've yet to see the results. I know it's been done in another area where it was a very poor community, and I don't think it was done adequately, but I'm not sure whether the process itself didn't work or it wasn't done very well. I suspect there's no reason why it wouldn't work perfectly well. I see no reason why it wouldn't, except you might need a little bit more help to structure it and to drive it and to get across the understanding of how it would work because of levels of education.
All right. Jerry, thanks a lot for sharing this with us, and I trust this is going to be quite interesting to many of our listeners who never heard of this before.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, Jörg. It's been a pleasure.